Die Eisbach ist Band, die zu Lynch. Show your stomach you can. Eat the rich. Pull the rich ass of the power back to shame. Selling out with all the love we know who's too bad. Man, I'm tired of being a new love. Best to forget. Eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Eat the rich. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the rich.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Now don't you think that that's rude? It's gone. Eat the rich.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Oh, the rich has the power.
This is KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Tsang. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today we're going to have a variety of guests on. First off, we're going to talk with Ken Good, who's actually a policy analyst at the National Center for National Security Studies at Washington, D.C., and they're at the forefront of organizing the people who are concerned about this kind of rush to judgment that resulted in the so-called U.S. Patriot Law last week. So we're going to talk to him about that, and we're going to ask him also why the Center for National Security Studies is also asking the government to release the names of everybody who has been detained since 9/11. So let's go to that interview. And we're going to get to our interview with Ken Good, who's the policy analyst at the Center for National Security Studies in Washington, D.C.
Okay, why did the center write a letter asking for information about the people who are incarcerated?
Well, we feel very strongly that as citizens we have a responsibility to oversee the actions of the government. And the veil of secrecy surrounding this investigation calls into question whether or not they are following the framework of the law as the Attorney General has asserted.
But isn't there a new law that says people can be detained basically for a long time without any anything?
Well, the new legislation that was passed and signed by the President on October 26th does grant the Attorney General some new powers of detention. However, the vast majority of the people that have been arrested or detained in this investigation were detained well before that date. And the unprecedented level of secrecy surrounding it certainly is not included in the new law as well.
There's even a guy in Orange County who was already in jail, but he had a Bin Laden tattoo on his chest or on his body, and he was detained further as a result of this hysteria about terrorism.
Well, we've heard bits and pieces of stories and clearly are very, very troubling. Unfortunately, we don't really know the facts of all of these cases. And I think we should make very clear that we really are taking no position on the actual detentions themselves until we have the specific facts of each case. And that's what we're trying to find out. We don't know if the government has sufficient grounds to detain these people. And we won't know that until we hear from the government about our request, which was for simply the names of the people who were detained, the grounds for their detention, any secrecy orders that have been asked for by the government in these cases, and the names of their lawyers if they have any.
Are they saying that it's to protect their privacy?
You mean the government is trying to protect their privacy, or we're trying to protect their privacy?
Oh, they are. Are they trying to protect their privacy by not giving it up?
In the United States, if you are arrested, you have absolutely no right to keep that information private. Everyone, the citizenry, has a right to know who the government arrests and whether or not you want that information to be released. That's not a decision that you get to make.
So, do you know right now, are they mostly Arabic people? Do you have any idea?
No, that is the assumption. But we don't know that because we don't know who the government has arrested. We don't even know their names. And certainly, the majority of the press reports have been other people of Arabic descent. And that is the general assumption. but we don't know for sure.
Well, the press also say that now the figure is up to 800 or so?
Oh, well, actually, we've heard that it's up to 1,087.
Wow.
Been detained since September 11th. Now, there was a report yesterday that some good high number of them have actually been released, but that really is not of our concern. Even if they've been released, we want the details and the information of those cases. Simply because the government has let them go doesn't mean that we should not then know who they were, why they were detained, and so on.
There was a report of a student in Irvine who was sent to New York as a material witness because he apparently knew two of the people that turned out to be supposedly the hijackers in San Diego, and he was rounded up by the FBI on a street in Irvine, I think, or around Irvine. They had raided other people, but he was the only one held as material witness. And I was just wondering what powers do they have to hold people as a material witness? Is that indefinite or what?
Go ahead. The material witness statute is a little bit murky in this regard because it has not really been used for detention and investigation. The material witness statute was crafted to ensure that witnesses are able to testify before the grand jury or in court about information they have. It is not intended for the government to allow the government to detain people and then investigate them. And we have heard cases of people being arrested or detained on material witness charges in San Diego or in other parts of the country, transported around the country without any notice to their family members, to their attorneys if they have them, to their, if they're not citizens, to their consuls, which is required by the government to form foreign consulates if they have detained citizens of their country. And so this broad expansion of the material witness statute is a little troubling.
I heard that it was mainly used in the past in mafia cases. Is that right?
I'm not going to comment on what's been used in the past for unfortunately. I just don't have that.
How about in terms of immigration detention? A lot of the cases seem to be ending up as immigration cases, and so they're saying that they have to be deported. Is that
what we are seeing is much closer scrutiny given to on immigration cases, and we would like some information and obviously some details about that. What we're hearing is press reports of people being detained for 21 days for overstaying their visa for 2 days, or very minor immigration charges, which would traditionally prior to September 11th have been disposed of by the courts very quickly. Now the government is detaining people for a very long period of time on very minor immigration charges, and while they may have grounds, that is certainly cause for concern.
Are they allowed to keep people indefinitely?
The law is very muddled on that. The new law allows the government to hold them for 7 days without bringing charges, but then after 7 days they must bring a charge and hold a hearing. Then the case goes before the immigration judge, and if they are to be deported, then they can hold them indefinitely until they can find a country to ever accept them.
I thought there was a case was it a Court of Appeals or Supreme Court that said that they can't hold people indefinitely on immigration charges?
Oh, well, certainly there have been cases that have argued that, and we feel strongly that you should not be able to have indefinite detention, and that was one of the major points of contention in the negotiations, or almost the lack of negotiations regarding the new anti-terrorism legislation. We feel the implications of this new legislation will have brings great cause for concern in the immigration field.
Because what happens if the country doesn't have a, you know, extradition treaty or whatever, or doesn't, U.S. doesn't have relations with
it? Well, the problem really is if we're going to deport somebody back to their home country, which is usually where we try and send them, if their home country won't accept them, then we're kind of stuck with them. And usually in that case, the immigrant has the authority and the ability to apply for relief and can be released in that way. But now we're seeing the Attorney General detain people indefinitely, or have the authority to detain people indefinitely without having that legal recourse.
Do permanent residents have more rights?
Immigrants who are permanent residents?
Yeah. So if the visas are okay,
they haven't had any immigration violations, then they have the right to detain them. However, if they commit a felony or if they go through a normal process on deportation, then they don't have any more rights than somebody who's out of status.
So you suspect that most of these are foreign people?
We suspect that most of them are non-citizens. However, there certainly is likely to be American citizens caught up in this as well.
And can they, before this new law, could they hold them indefinitely also, or what?
No, they could not, depending on the interpretation that you make. I don't want to comment too specifically on that because I'm not an immigration lawyer.
How about this new, so the effect of this new law is basically they can hold people indefinitely?
That could be one outcome of it, certainly, yes.
Are they just foreigners? Non-citizens, they can do that too? Or?
Yes, non-citizens.
How about, what are other aspects of the new law that trouble you?
Well, the most troubling feature of the new legislation is that, not specific aspects of it, but the whole process, and that was that if this was a careful examination of what went wrong in the build-up to the September 11th attacks, we would feel much more comfortable about the legislation that passed. Unfortunately, what had happened was the law enforcement community and the intelligence community put together in 8 days a collection of all of their old proposals that they had not been able to get enacted, and they've taken advantage of the climate surrounding the country and the legislature after September 11th to basically rush through a bill without any careful examination, without even any deferred debate hardly, or any hearings in committee. And we feel that process was just drastically flawed. There are serious problems with the actual legislation itself, too numerous to go into now, but the process was the most egregious.
What is the main problem with the legislation?
It broadens the capacity of the intelligence community to spy on Americans. It eliminates really a lot of the safeguards that the civil liberties community had worked very hard for and successfully for over the last 25 years to limit the scope and limit the capabilities of the intelligence communities to spy on Americans.
I know the center has organized this group that was opposing this legislation, and it came. People came from the right and the left. What happened to that coalition?
Well, the coalition, and I think we should make clear, the coalition took no position on the legislation. The coalition was arguing, and they released a 10-point statement, in that in this time of crisis, we should be deliberative. We should ensure that the actions that we take reflect the careful examination of what went wrong. And that did not happen. The coalition itself, the In Defense of Freedom Coalition, did not take a position on the legislation.
What should people do if the FBI knocks on their door?
Well, they should try and cooperate as best as they can. I don't have a good answer for that.
But they have a right to remain silent, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This new legislation has not changed in any way people's constitutional rights in terms of cooperation with authorities.
So even non-citizens have constitutional rights?
There's two aspects to that. If you're in this country, the Constitution applies to you. And also, the laws and regulations governing the law enforcement agencies certainly apply, regardless of whether or not you're investigating American citizens or non-citizens.
But can the CIA pose as interview you without saying that they're from the CIA within the U.S.?
The CIA is not chartered for domestic surveillance, and they cannot legally do any investigation or surveillance in the United States.
So what happens if you work for the government? Can they do that, or would they have to send the FBI to do the investigation?
I believe they would be required to send the FBI, but I'm not an expert on that.
What's the next, down the road seems to be legislation involving foreign students. Senator Feinstein originally had a proposal to ban all foreign student visas for 6 months, but she seems to have backed off on that.
I believe that is the case, yes, but we would certainly be very active in opposing that legislation.
think the students are the, I mean, being a student is the cause for, you know, terrorism.
No, I think that certainly greater scrutiny is necessary to ensure that the people we do accept and allow into the United States are law-abiding and respectable citizens. However, not the actions and just simply banning everyone is not the answer.
Does this legislation already ban certain courses or certain people from certain countries from taking certain university courses, for instance?
I'm afraid I'm just not sure of that. So
I think, how about the, in terms of possessing, I heard that this legislation or maybe proposed legislation would ban people from possessing certain type of biological agents, so that even if you're a graduate student from...
Again, I'm not sure.
So what do you think, what's the atmosphere like in Washington? Are people like, I mean, it did take a few weeks for this to pass, so do you think...
Even though the process went through, it did take a few weeks, the process in the House was much more deliberative than the process in the Senate, and the climate that was whipped up by both the Attorney General and some of the Republican members of the Senate did not help. We had a situation where the Attorney General was basically making a statement saying that if there was another attack prior to the legislation being passed, it would be Senator Leahy's fault because he's holding up legislation.
How about data sharing? Is there anything in the proposed legislation, the legislation, or the, anything proposed that would...
The information sharing provisions are troubling, certainly, and the fact that now the Attorney General and the Inspector of the FBI are required to share all foreign intelligence information that they collect with the Central Intelligence Agency is troubling.
Does that mean they could share it with a foreign liaison?
Well, of course, once it gets into the Central Intelligence Agency, it can be distributed to the entire intelligence community. And so we could be sharing it with the French Secret Service or the British Secret Service as well, and that's a little troubling.
I thought that, you know, there was this Privacy Act, right, that constrains the U.S. from sharing information with other people, and you don't think, is that now kind of...
I think certainly provisions of this new legislation override that.
Really? Wow. Okay, well, what's your position there? At the center, what do you do there?
I'm a policy analyst.
So that was talking with Ken Gude, G-U-D-E, at the Center for National Security Studies in Washington, D.C. Petition that they mentioned, or the statement that he mentioned, called In Defense of Freedom, is on the website at www.indefenseoffreedom.org. And defense is spelled with an S. D-E-F-E-N-S-E. Indefenseoffreedom.org. And that has a statement from the group of law professors, computer people, and organizations that are urging them to not rush to judgment. The CNSS, the Center for National Security website, is at George Washington University, so it's www.gwu.edu/CNSS. Coming up, we're going to talk with a lawyer for a high school student who tried to start an anarchist club and also wear t-shirts protesting the war on Afghanistan and was stopped by a judge. So let's go to that after a short break. So that was Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Any War. And there's a student in West Virginia who decided not to march to the tune of war. She tried to start an anarchy club at her high school, Sissonville High School in West Virginia, and also wore t-shirts protesting the U.S. war and U.S. attack on Afghanistan. And her name is Katie Sierra. Well, her case caused a lot of trouble in the in the school system. They freaked out. The Kanawha County School Board on yesterday said that she couldn't wear that t-shirt and she couldn't start an anarchy club because the judge decided that that was akin to starting a violence club. So the judge should read more about anarchy. But anyway, we were able to talk to her attorney this morning, Roger Foreman from West Virginia, who is Sierra's attorney, who is geared up for the long haul, and he's willing to take her case up to the state Supreme Court in West Virginia. And here's the interview with Roger Foreman. We asked him about what was going on in this case.
Okay, what was the case about? Why did, was the school really upset at the idea of an anarchist club?
There were two things, actually three issues involved immediately. One was the anarchist club. She came in with the request to form an anarchist club, and the principal immediately denied her, although her anarchist club isn't a violent revolutionary club, and she had constitutional documents drawn up. It was basically discussion and peace information that she was trying to share. That was number one. Number two, she was wearing t-shirts that were hand-printed t-shirts with messages of love and anti-racism and peace, and those offended the principal as well. So he suspended her after another student. Here's what happened, if you want me to quote it exactly. Another student heard her, someone read the message on her shirt to the other student, and the student said, if you don't love this country, then the student was sent out of the classroom, and then later in the day, and everything ended. Later in the day, the principal called her and then suspended her for failure to obey his orders and not following the rules, and she was suspended for 3 days. And when she came back to school, she was allowed to wear her shirt one day, and then the second day the principal asked it removed, and then we went to court.
What was the third thing? You said there were three things.
The suspension.
Oh, the suspension, okay.
Yeah.
But was she herself an anarchist or what?
She's not sure. She's into studying anarchism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, that's cool. So what's the next step now, since the suspension? Are you fighting that, or?
Went to court, and the judge denied us an injunction. So she's back to school today, but without her shirts and not able to form her club.
Isn't that a total violation of free speech?
Absolutely, and I think the judge was wrong, and we're discussing an appeal of it at this point.
So this is just at the local level at this point?
Well, the court was the local level. The court above it is the Supreme Court where we would go.
In West, where are you?
In the Supreme Court, yes.
Oh, wow. So, is she getting any support from other students, or?
She has a core of students, she says 15 to 20, who support her very strongly.
And has the club been meeting already?
No, the club has never met. The principal immediately denied and would not reconsider allowing that club. Although we're in negotiations to have the club under another name at this point.
Hold for a few minutes.
So the name is what's the problem?
It may be.
That's funny. That
the club itself is it is not the violent overthrow.
Are there student clubs right now that meet on campus?
Oh, yes.
So, as I understand, under the open access rules, once they allow one club, they have to allow any other.
Well, that's not the case here, because the court didn't think the principal was out of line. But if it goes up, I think that'll change.
So What was the argument, the concern about the name? I mean, did they say it was disruptive or what?
He says anarchism is violent overthrow and he won't allow that. Hey, I got the school board's attorney online too.
Okay.
And I need to go.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Is that clear enough?
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
So that was Roger Furman defending a 15-year-old girl at Sissonville High School, at Sissonville High School, who was suspended for 3 days because she wore a T-shirt, an anarchist T-shirt, and she was trying to a T-shirt against the war, and she was trying to start an anarchy club at Sissonville High School in West Virginia. With us on the phone is also another. News story, people involved with another news story, which is the Sarah Olson case. And welcome to Subversity.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Is this Mary and Hadassah?
Hadassah.
Yeah, from the Sarah Olson Defense Fund Committee in Los Angeles.
Correct.
Why did Sarah Olson, who was up in a case involving a 60s matter of a placing of a bomb in a LAPD a vehicle, why did she plead guilty?
Mary, you want me to go first, or do you want to go first?
You go ahead.
Well, she pled guilty because there was no way she was going to get a fair trial. First of all, you know what the situation is in our country now, that everybody is scared to death of quote, terrorists, end quote. They think the police are all heroes. And her defense was going to be based on the fact that she fled because of she was afraid of the police. There is a lot of evidence that connects her with people who were involved with the SLA, but there's no evidence that connects her to any of the criminal activities of the SLA, and there's certainly no evidence that connects her directly to the crimes for which she was committed.
Given that,
she was prepared to go to trial, but when you look at the situation in this country right now, it becomes clear that she can't get a fair trial. And if you were in the courtroom on Wednesday, you would have known one of the reasons why she can't get a fair trial.
She wasn't there in L.A. when the bombs were placed, right?
That's what she says, and there appears to be evidence to that effect, that somehow or other disappeared while it was in the custody of the DA's office and the police.
But now because she went outside the courtroom and said that she was not guilty, the judge is having a hearing on Monday?
Tuesday, to
consider the plea.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that's going to go?
Well, it's my opinion and the opinion of a lot of the criminal attorneys on this case that the judge doesn't have the jurisdiction to do anything about the plea, and that he's just annoyed because she seemed to be saying that she couldn't get a fair trial in his courtroom, and I think he just annoyed him. I don't know what... why he's even bothering with this.
I understand a lot of defendants actually say they're innocent even when they plead guilty.
Yes, there's a case in California called West versus the People versus West, and that case was decided back in 1970 and has continually been the basis for pleas of that are entered whether or not the defendant is guilty. In fact, in West, the defendant could not have been guilty of the crime that he pled guilty to, and the court knew that, the prosecutors knew that, his defense attorneys knew that, but he stood to get such a terrible sentence on the crime for which he was indicted that he was willing to plead guilty to a much lesser offense in order to get the lower plea, even though everybody knew he wasn't guilty.
But of course, there's a risk, you know. Did the committee realize that the judge would get mad at this development?
I assumed, since her attorneys were with her when she made those statements, that it was okay to make them. I didn't predict that the judge would get angry.
I'd like to give a little background on the case, assuming that not everyone knows the basis for
the SLA is the Symbionese Liberation Army. Right.
Well, let's go back a little. There was an indictment on Sarah in 1976 for allegedly putting pipe bombs under police cars and conspiracy to blow up police cars with the intent to commit murder. So that conspiracy charge is very important. Sarah was arrested just 2.5 years ago in Minnesota on this indictment from 1976. Now, why this case was opened up and Sarah was found and arrested, we don't know. But what it came down to was the prosecution had no evidence on the count for putting pipe bombs under police cars. So what they did was take advantage of the conspiracy charge. And what they were doing, and with the permission of the first judge on this case, whose name was Judge James Eideman, they were going to bring in evidence and witnesses on 22 felony counts of crimes allegedly committed by the Symbionese Liberation Army. So what this was meaning is they were bringing in crimes committed by, allegedly committed by an organization before Sarah even had association with the organization.
Wow.
And her association with the organization was that her best friend, Angela Atwood, who she waited tables with in Berkeley, happened to go underground, unbeknownst to Sarah, and was in the firebombing and murdered by the LAPD in 1974. So Sarah, at a rally in Berkeley, that was a rally to commemorate this murder, along with 20 other people, Sarah gave a speech eulogizing her friend. And at that point, she was targeted and watched by the powers that be. The SLA was dead. Sarah was never a member of the SLA. But she eulogized her friend and later on took some actions to help protect other people so they would not be killed by police. And this is why she's arrested. They have no evidence. She was not in LA when these alleged bombs were placed. Wendy Yoshimura's diary places her outside of LA, and that's a piece of evidence that has disappeared. And so, in order to get Sarah and put her in jail for life, now this is a woman, she's been my friend for over 20 years in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We did anti-apartheid work together, she's been active in the community, she's done nothing but an exemplary person in her community. And the prosecution is going way out of their way to use the conspiracy law, which is very dangerous and many people think should be abolished, to put her away for life.
Did the Patty Hearst claim in her biography that Sarah Olson was at the scene?
Patty Hearst's book, yes, written 8 years after she did her prison time and on which she made $800,000, is the base for this prosecution, yes.
So you think she was lying?
I think there are lies in that book, yes, lots of lies.
So why do you think, what was the political reason for going after Sarah Olson after all these years?
Well, that's, you know, only something that can be projected. The police officer who opened the case back up and started looking for Sarah and getting it put on America's Most Wanted was the son, Tom King. He was the son of Marvin King. Marvin King was the police officer in charge of the action where the shootout happened in South Central LA, where six members of the SLA were incinerated by the LAPD. So what motivated him? There's lots of projection about that, whether the LAPD needed to win a big case to, you know, make them look better after the Rampart scandal, or, you know, the climate of the country, it was time to get somebody because of what happened up in Seattle, and they wanted to show the young progressive left that USERRA to and make an example out of her, that this can come back to you some years later. You know, it's all projection how this actually came down.
So you were friends with, you said you were friends with her for two decades or so. Did you know she was linked to the group before, when she had this new identity in Minnesota?
No, I didn't. I found out when she was arrested on June 16th, 1999.
So, I mean, was the committee notified or consulted before she made this guilty plea?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Sorry, was the Defense Fund Committee consulted before she pleaded guilty?
Well, we're not part of her legal team.
Oh, I see.
We're there as Sarah's support network. So, no, we weren't privy to all the conversations, no.
So it must have come as a shock.
Well, we knew something was up, and it's always something that takes place in a case like this, the opportunity to make a plea of some sort. So it's, you know, for a lot of people that are supporting Sarah are attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild and other attorneys, and so it's not a huge surprise to people, and especially after the September 11th events, where it's clear that it'd be very difficult to get a fair trial because the prosecution was going to go out of their way to label her a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, you know.
But you know, the judge refused the Sarah's plea for postponement, right?
Yes, he did. But he did leave it open to wait and to see when after the jurors were questioned and see if it was, if they could find a jury that was impartial.
I mean, given that she pleaded guilty, do you think she would have gotten a better deal if she pleaded guilty before 9/11? I mean, if, you know, of course nobody could predict 9/11, but
that's too hard to project. I don't know. This has been very, very complicated and difficult.
So, do you? There was an article in today's LA Times, I believe, interviewing people who were supporters in Minnesota also, talking about how surprised they were at this turn of developments.
Well, people assume the trial is going ahead. And no, it's not something that everyone gets to be privy to, that these discussions are going on. So some people were surprised, yes.
But are you now fearing that the trial will still go on?
Fearing that it might go on still?
Yeah. That the judge might say, you know, might reject the guilty plea and have the trial go on?
Well, I really would be surprised if he has that jurisdiction, but anything could happen. That's my line in the last 2.5 years.
Well, judges have kind of control over the courtroom. They can basically do anything they want within the courtroom.
Yeah, you know that.
But are you prepared for that eventuality?
Well, we were totally prepared to go forward with trials. So, yeah, we're prepared. We're here. I mean, we're not her defense team. We're her support team.
Support team, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have a broad base, actually, a broad group of people that are that have been supporting her financially as well as emotionally, I suppose.
Yes. And that's how I came out here. We networked with people out here by coming out and doing trips over the last 2 years, speaking and meeting people, and these people are sustaining me. I'm living at Hadassah's house. And
right.
Yeah, so it's an amazing group of people out here that never knew Sarah before. That are standing behind her because they understand the political nature of this trial and what it means for all of us, especially now with this the climate that's existing, the new anti-terrorist laws, you know, our civil liberties being threatened. It's very scary what it means for people on the left.
Because especially they could say anybody is linked to some group that they label as terrorists, and then they could do, you know, investigation, hold you, especially people who aren't citizens, for a long
exactly.
time.
Exactly. It doesn't even have to be terrorists. You know, people were arrested in the 60s to going over the state line to the Democratic Convention, you know, and were arrested for crossing the state line because they were supposedly going to incite a riot, you know.
Right,
that's
right.
how conspiracy laws work. It doesn't have to be much.
Was this a new law, the conspiracy law, that was enacted in the 60s, or do you know?
No,
it's been around since the Star Chambers in the Middle Ages.
That was
the basis for prosecutions. It's been the basis for prosecutions of people that the power structure doesn't like for years and years and years and years. And it's been used in this country ever since the beginning of the founding of the country. It came down from the English common law and became codified in U.S. law.
You know, there's a lot of talk now about grand juries. There's a grand jury impaneled since the World Trade Center attacks. And was a grand jury used in her case?
Yes, but I would like to quote at a prosecutor whose name I don't remember, but he was talking about the grand jury, and he was a prosecutor, and his comment about the grand jury was, I could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
I've heard that quote, yeah. It's because the...
So, indictments aren't, you know, and the grand jury just doesn't serve the function one would theoretically hope that it would serve. It does the prosecutor's bidding.
And also the defense cannot bring in their lawyer.
Right.
During the grand jury proceeding. You can
That's
go outside.
Correct.
You can go outside and talk to that person, but you can't have
right.
that person inside.
Right. Yeah. Only the prosecutor's there.
With
that sounds fair, doesn't it?
Sounds like a Star Chamber.
Right.
And this was back in 1976.
Right. And now now there's this whole... We were talking earlier in this hour with somebody from the Center for National Security Studies who's analyzing the new terrorism law and also trying to get the names of people incarcerated. And he was saying that a lot of the people were brought in under the theory that they were material witnesses.
Right.
And therefore they could be detained, basically, it seemed to be indefinitely.
Right. And a lot of people, I understand, are being detained on minor charges.
Right. Like your visa expired a week
right.
ago or something. Yeah.
So you're deportable, and once you're deportable, you can be detained forever.
That's
until they get around to deporting you.
And if the country doesn't want you, then you're definitely in limbo land.
You know, and our country claims that there are no political prisoners, but the day after the September 11th events, people like Daniel Berrigan, or is it Philip Berrigan, and Marilyn Buck, who is a prisoner in California, they were put in solitary confinement with no access to their attorneys.
Really? They were already...
That's supposed to mean, you know.
They were already in prison, and they were...
They were in prison, and for a few days to a week, they were put in solitary confinement after the September 11th attacks.
That's crazy.
And we don't have any political prisoners.
There's a whole... some people did get released, recently. Yes. And their cases seem to have fared better. Even some people that came up recently for 60s-related alleged crimes.
Or
80s or whatever, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Bombing
yes,
the
we've,
Congress.
Yes, we've gotten to know Linda Evans. She's one of the people that were pardoned by Clinton.
Right.
She lives in L.A. right now, and she's, supported Sarah.
Yeah, and Linda has come down to meet with students here at UC Irvine, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. And I saw the movie, the film.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really moving movie, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe you could talk about that movie. What's the title of that?
Out? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Out.
That's Laura Whitehorn's story?
Right, right.
Right, she was released from prison a couple years ago.
And she was active in this, a network of political prisoners, right? And their supporters, of course. There's a whole network of people supporting them and speaking
yes.
out.
Yes, and many of the people, aside from the National Lawyers Guild, have been from these prison coalitions that have come forward to support Sarah out here.
Yeah, yeah. Are you getting... Is the media coverage friendly to or supportive, or what do you think? How would you analyze the media coverage?
Well, until recently, it was decidedly negative. It's gotten more fair recently. I mean, we've
really? Got that's interesting.
Media that's at least willing to listen to us and to quote us, you know, correctly rather than misstating what our positions.
Yeah. You're listening to Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The number here is 949-824-5824. If you want to chat with two supporters of the Sarah Olson case, Mary Sutton and Hadassah Gilbert, 824-5824 here in Orange County. Do you feel that the international, has the international media been covering this case at all? Any reporters from
other? Reuters has been covering it, and somebody from London has been covering it. Those are the two people I know. I have, Mary may know
it. Canada. There's some couple contacts in Canada.
Oh.
And actually, there was a man from, where was he from? One of the Nordic countries came and interviewed us in Minnesota quite a long time ago.
Oh, I see. Huh. I know there was a cookbook even, wasn't there a cookbook to raise funds?
Yeah.
What was that about?
We produced a cookbook in Minnesota called Serving Time, America's Most Wanted Recipes.
I bought one for the library here.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Yeah, Sarah has a certificate in culinary arts, and that's one thing that all her friends know her for. She can really lay out a feast and wonderful food. And when she was arrested in Minnesota in 1999, you know, we were hanging out at her home with her husband, you know, to support him and just brainstorming on what are we going to do. And someone threw out the idea of doing a cookbook. And so there was an attorney who took some of Sarah's cookbooks and her notes and her recipe cards to her in jail and said, get to work, they're picking out recipes. And it turned out to be quite a large project, but it came off pretty well. And that's one of our fundraising tools.
That's a great title.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you think it's great, because there are people who find it offensive. I mean, we all thought it was very amusing. I'm glad you understand the humor of it, because, you know, some people just decided it was just being too flip about the whole thing.
The people
who can't laugh, you're lost.
Yeah, I think you have to kind of, you know, keep the sense of humor in these tense times, otherwise it would just go crazy.
Right.
Do you feel that, are they tensing up? I mean, you mentioned something about Dan Berrigan and Marilyn Buck, but do you think, are there other situations in prisons where they're cracking down since 9/11?
I heard about those examples, and I don't know specifically, no. That would be a good show, though, to contact some of these people who are involved in these coalitions who do know those. It'd be interesting.
And whether, you know, supporters can visit people now. Since then, is it harder to visit, pay visits and
right,
you know,
I don't know that.
Same stuff, yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think is down the road? Does it look, I mean, the big hurdle is Tuesday, I guess, about this judge, the Fidler, right? What he's going to do.
Right.
Do you, if the trial goes on, it would start October 5th, I mean, not October, it would be, we'll start.
Well, it had already started, so I don't know what would happen if it went forward now. I don't know what date would be set, or if it would just go on right from that date. I can't tell you that.
Were jurors already being picked, or what?
They were in the process of being picked, yeah.
Oh. So were they questioned about 9/11, or how did they...
No, all they did so far was screen jurors for their ability to fit, I don't know, a very long trial.
Why would it take 6 months or whatever?
Because the prosecution is introducing evidence of 22 uncharged felonies. And when you have 22 counts, 22 crimes that you're trying to prove, there are a lot of witnesses, and that's what takes the time.
There was even a case, was it in Seattle, that somebody said in the paper today? Was there another case that they were saying that because of the evidence that covered? What was that?
Now, there's been an ongoing investigation for years and years and years and years of the Carmichael Bank robbery up in Sacramento.
Oh, Sacramento, yeah.
And, you know,
they're trying to
think four or five different Sacramento County DAs have declined to prosecute because there's not enough evidence. The only evidence they have is Patricia Hearst's say-so.
So now they're dredging up that
right case
and trying to pin it on Sarah.
Right, and I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that dredging that up is just propaganda trying to inflame people against her.
The prosecution has used things like that and actually, you know, saying that Sarah is likely to get accused of the murdering. There was a woman that was murdered in the bank robbery in Carmichael, which is highly unfortunate. But Sarah didn't murder this woman. And there's no evidence connecting Sarah to this bank robbery whatsoever. And but they've taken that and used it to create propaganda in the media. And there's a police officer involved. One of the police officers that were in one of these police cars has also come forward after 25 years with total memory recall. All of a sudden, he recognized Sarah as the woman he saw looking at him with hatred in her eyes 25 years ago, and he has also filed a civil suit against Sarah.
Oh,
you know, it's clear that there's a fabrication of witnesses and everything. This guy has... You know, it's nuts. Nowhere in his report from the day does he say this, and nowhere in the grand jury report does he say that he remembers seeing anyone. But the prosecution dredged him up, and all of a sudden he has a recovered memory of knowing for a fact that this was Sarah Olson, you know, who wasn't even in L.A. at the time, so...
On the bombing, planting the bomb case, was the prosecution going to bring in Patty Hearst as a witness?
Oh, yes.
And they say they have strong evidence, right?
That's what they say, but Patty Hearst, you know, she wasn't even allowed to be a witness. And there was one Carmichael, Sarah's brother was charged in the Carmichael bank robbery and acquitted. And Patty Hearst wasn't allowed to even be a witness because she's not credible. And so why today she would be credible is, you know, I've done a lot of reading about Patty Hearst and different variations on this story, and there's absolutely no reason, there's no way of knowing what happened, and there's no way of knowing, I mean, there's lots of ways of knowing that Patty Hearst is not telling the truth.
Her
book is the base for the prosecution, totally.
Why is she not reliable? Why did you feel that she's not reliable?
Because what she writes about doesn't correspond with what some other people write about.
I see. Yeah.
And, you know,
she's made lots of inconsistent statements.
Mm-hmm.
Is she married to a policeman now? Or?
Yeah.
Well, is he a policeman?
He was a security guard in the prison. She falls in love with whoever she's around.
I think a lot of people do that, but so I don't know if that's, that's a guilty thing. But anyway, in any case, in terms of support, do you think the support is withering now because of the guilty plea or not?
Oh, I don't think so, and it's too soon to tell. We're meeting tonight, the committee here in L.A., just to reevaluate our focus. You know, I don't believe people will take away support because of this. No, people understand, particularly people who understand in the first place, the nature of the conspiracy charge and what was really going on.
So she's actually charged with conspiracy to plant the bombs.
Pardon me?
The actual charge is conspiracy to plant the bombs.
That's one of the counts, yes, conspiracy. And that's why Sarah took the plea, because the burden of proof in conspiracy charge is so low. You can get convicted by your association with an individual.
It's basically
they had no evidence in the count for placing bombs under police cars.
And the bombs didn't explode, right?
Right. No one was hurt. Bombs didn't explode. No one was killed.
They found the bombs. And
but it traumatized this police officer's life so much.
Hmm. So are you going to show up at the courthouse on Tuesday?
Oh, yeah.
How has that been? Has there been a lot of people showing up, a call group or what?
Yeah, we were starting to schedule people in, and we've had, a couple of rows of people.
Can you carry signs or anything now?
Not in the courtroom. We did have a rally the first day of the trial.
Outside?
Out front, and we thought we'd do that sporadically here and there.
So that was okay, doing it outside? Nobody freaked out?
No, but we didn't put sticks on our signs. We held them, and, we were pretty diplomatic, and we gave press statements, and we presented 1,100 signatures to the DA that day, requesting that the charges against Sarah be dropped.
And is this done in LA County? Is it a state court or federal court? What is
state.
It? State. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
millions and millions of dollars are being spent to prosecute a woman that's been nothing but an asset in her community,
And she, she led a peaceful life. I mean, in Minnesota.
That's why Wild County Hospital can't treat people.
What do you mean?
Well, the money that should be going to County Hospital is being spent on this prosecution.
Yeah, there's a lot of disparities in use of resources.
And city money, which should be being spent on all kinds of things that this city needs, is being spent on filling the courtroom with uniformed police officers whose only function there was to intimidate. One of the police officers who was in court, and there were loads of them, one of them, when asked why he was there, was said, oh, the district attorney told us to show up. Now, that's no way to spend city money.
Also, he was...
I'm sure they were getting paid for their time.
So
there were 24 members of the bomb squad with guns at their sides in the courtroom.
So the DA was packing the courtroom, basically.
Right, yes.
Oh. So are you hopeful? Are you optimistic about Tuesday's hearing, or what's your feeling right now?
Who knows what optimistic means in this context?
Yeah, these days.
We don't know.
How did the family take it? Were they really shocked too? They really. I know that there were pictures of people crying and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Her mother.
Sarah's daughter and Sarah's mother were both in tears.
Right. How old is the daughter?
She's got three daughters.
Oh, are they grown up?
Mary knows. 15, 19, and 21. So a lot of lives are affected by this.
Yeah. So did they move out here, the family? To be with
no, her. They're coming. If the trial moves forward, they were planning to be here.
I see.
If Sarah goes to prison in California, it's just no one's been able to make any concrete plans because this is ever-changing.
Yes, yeah. It's so iffy. You have a website, actually, huh?
Yes, www.saraholsondefense.com.
Defense with a S. With a S. D-E-F-E-N-S-E. Right. Or is it with a C? Is it
Sarah Olson Defense.
With a S or with a C? Defense?
D-E-F-E-N-S-E.
S-E, okay.
Yeah.
.com.
Sorry.
Just think of the British spelling.
Oh.
Yeah. So, okay. So people can contact you through the website.
Yeah.
If they want to.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're coming up to the end of our time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All righty.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Thank you. That was Mary Sutton and Hadassah Gilbert from the Sarah Jane Olson Defense Fund Committee, which is organizing on her support, on her behalf, as she pleaded guilty to planting bombs or conspiracy to plant bombs in an LAPD car. But she says that she pleaded guilty because she thought she could not get a fair trial. And the judge is going to hold a hearing on her plea on Tuesday. You've been listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Earlier we talked with Roger Foreman, the lawyer for a 15-year-old anarchist supporter who wanted to start a group, a high school's anarchy group, and was wearing anti-war t-shirts, and she's been stopped from doing both.
as the lawyer ponders taking the case to this West Virginia Supreme Court. And we also talked with Ken Good from the Center for National Security Studies about the new so-called Patriot Law and the and how many people, he says over 1,000 now, have been incarcerated in the wake of 9/11, held indefinitely, some, although some have been released. The Center for National Security Studies in Washington has been trying to get a list of names of people who have been detained. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM, and on our website at Subversity, you can go to go.fast.to/SV. go.fast.to/SV for more details on this show and other shows, and also the real audio versions of this program that you can listen to on your computer. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.
It's Good News Week.